Okay, so I think maybe we can start this evening's talk. Tonight I'm going to talk about the topic of non-self, of anatta, it is known in the Pali language. And this is like one of the core things of Buddhism, this idea of non-self. And it's quite important to get an understanding and a feeling for what it actually means. So you get a kind of sense for the core aspect of Buddhism, what it is, what this is all about. I'm going to talk about it from mostly a practical point of view, how to understand this from one's own personal experience, but also how to actually use it in maybe even ordinary life, how to use this idea to develop wholesome states of mind in ordinary life. And it is interesting, it is a core aspect of Buddhist practice because there is a place in the suttas where the Buddha talks about what is it that differentiates, what is the difference between his teaching, the Dhamma, and the teaching of all the other religions that existed at the time of the Buddha. And they go through a number of things. They talk about the understanding of, I think, feelings, and understanding of clinging or upadana, talk about a number of things. And the Buddha says, well, in all these cases, there is a possibility that people of other traditions, other teachings, may also have a similar kind of understanding to that of the Buddhists. But there's one area, the Buddha declares, where the Buddha's teaching is different. It's more profound, it's more complete, and that is especially in the area of non-self, understanding this idea of anatta that we talk about in the sutta. So this is kind of the archetypal kind of Buddhist thing, right? This idea of non-self. So because it is so important in the Buddha's teachings, and I think Buddhism is the only religion, I think, only philosophy perhaps, that lays such emphasis on this idea of non-self. So because it is so important, it's good to have a concept, idea, of what it actually is all about. To approach this from a practical perspective, the idea of a self, the opposite of non-self, the idea of a self, what is that? What does it actually mean? And the idea of a self is like the sense of I you have inside of you, right? It's like the sense of identity, of being somebody specific. That is what the sense of I is all about. Sense of identity. Now, that sense of identity, what does it mean to have an identity? And what it means to have an identity, it means that there is something inside of you which has a kind of continuity, right? If you look at yourself in the mirror today and you look at the picture of maybe 10 or 20 years ago, you still have a sense that was me 20 years ago. The identity in anything always means that there is a kind of continuity from one point to a later point. That is the very meaning of identity. So when you think of yourself, when you think of the idea of a self, it means identity, the sense of I inside of you that we all have to some extent, except if you are fully enlightened perhaps. That sense of I is based on this idea of identity. If you look very carefully, you will see that that is actually what it is founded on. If you take away the sense of identity, the sense of I can no longer exist as a consequence. And to understand what this means, this idea of identity, imagine that you have a car, for example. Over the years, you keep on repairing this car. And eventually, after having repaired this car, say it's a really old car, right? You've been repairing it for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Eventually, there comes a time when every part of that car has been changed out, right? You have got a new engine in there, you've got new tires, new wheels, you've got new interior, a new steering wheel, a new roof, new windows. Everything has been changed out. Everything has been swapped over with something else. So the question then is, when everything has been changed, when there isn't a single screw or anything left in that car that was originally there, everything has been changed out, is it still the same car? Can you talk about an identity of that car anymore? Does that car have an identity? Is it the same thing? Or is it now something completely different? If somebody saw your car the way it was before, maybe before it was like a Beetle, right? Volkswagen Beetle, and now it looks like a Mercedes, then people would say, it's not the same car anymore. It's completely changed. Everything is different. So that's what we mean by something not having an identity, right? There's nothing which goes across. There's nothing that moves along with this car. The identity, there's no identity between what was there before and what is there afterwards. And this is exactly the same thing with a human being. If you understand the sense of identity, it is the idea that if there's no identity, it means that things are continuously changing. And there comes a point when nothing is there anymore of what was there before. And when you see that, when you can understand that fully, that is when you understand the idea of non-self. No identity, nothing passes over from one point to some other point later on. So this is what it's all about. And one of the interesting things, sometimes this is actually quite profound. It may sound very easy when you hear about this, but actually this is a very profound thing here. And so one of the things that you often will hear about, you will often hear in modern psychology or modern philosophy, people will say that, yeah, we realize there's no self. We understand that the Buddhist teaching must be correct on this particular view, because when we look inside of the psyche of a human being, when we philosophize about what it is that a human being is, we agree here. There's nothing there that is constant. There's nothing there that is unchanging. There's no identity that actually goes across. You will often hear that. It's quite common in modern psychology and also philosophy to say these kind of things. So does that mean that such people who say this kind of thing, does that mean that they have understood the idea of non-self because they say that? Have they really understood what's going on? And the answer is that they have only understood something very superficial, because all they have seen is some very superficial states of mind, and they have seen that these superficial things, they are changing all the time. And because of that, they have declared that there is no self. But if you look at that person's own psychology, if you look at their own sense of identity, their own sense of who they are, they still have the sense of I inside, which means that they haven't really understood it from a Buddhist point of view. All they have understood is this idea from a very superficial intellectual point of view. So what that means, and I think this is quite important to understand, when people say these things, that yes, we can see according to modern psychology that the Buddhist teaching must be right, they haven't really understood what the Buddha was talking about. It's far, far more profound. It goes to the very core of who we are. It goes to the very core of what we identify as human beings. And this is really what the Buddhist thing is about. So to get you to understand how this works, I will look a little bit about how to investigate this idea of non-self, how to investigate it inside of yourself, so you can also get an understanding roughly that roughly aligns with how the Buddha talked about non-self. So one of the ways that the Buddha talks about non-self, the Buddha often will classify the human being and he will divide the human being up into aspects. There's a very well-known way of dividing a human being up called the five khandhas, often translated as the five aggregates, which I think is a bad translation. Does that make any sense to you, five aggregates? It sounds like a pile of sand or a pile of gravel or something like that. Aggregates is something you use in the building industry, right? That's what it means to me anyway. It doesn't make any much sense to me, but basically what it means, a khandha is like a group. It's a whole set of things that come under a particular grouping. This is what the five khandhas actually mean. And so the Buddha says that a personality can be divided, if you like, into these five groupings. And when you look at those groupings carefully, then you will see that there is no identity within that particular group. This is one traditional way of analyzing, according to the Buddha's teaching, how we look at a person. That is one way. Another way that the Buddha talks about is through what he talks about the six sense faculties. And the six sense faculties in Buddhism are the ordinary five: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. And the sixth one of the Buddhist sense faculties is the mind state, the mind, the feeling of the mind. And the reason for that is because even if you shut down all the other five senses, you can still have awareness, and that awareness is the mental awareness. So this is another way of classifying. And if you look at those six sense doors, the six way of sensing the world, you will again see the same thing. There's no sense of identity going through that. So these are the ways the Buddha uses to explain this, and these categories are actually very, very useful. They are especially useful when your meditation becomes very deep, because then these categories start to get some kind of meaning. Yeah. But before that, they are a bit abstract. So I will instead look at another way of regarding this idea of non-self. And this idea is simply to remember that the world, what is the world? What is the world to us? The idea of non-self is that there's no identity, right? Well, if there's no identity, what are the things that don't have any identity? And the thing ultimately that has no identity is our experience of the world. If you want to summarize what the world is, if you want to summarize what reality is, you can say that reality is basically experience. There is nothing apart from experience, right? All of reality is included within experience. You see things, you hear things, you smell things, you touch things, you think about things, and that's all there is. There's nothing apart from that. So when you look at your experience of life, that is the sum total of reality. There is no reality really outside of experience. That is a very powerful thing, isn't it, when you think like that? It's a very, very useful way of looking at the world. Very often, just sidetracking a little bit, but very often you will hear that, you know, the world is often divided up, according to modern science, is divided up into material things on the one hand and then mental things on the other hand. And that division causes incredible problems for philosophy, for how to think about the world, because it's very hard to understand how that material world can interact with the mental world. Because the material world is one thing, the mental world is something completely different. So how can they interact? How can a human being exist? How can these things actually work together? But if you look at it from a Buddhist point of view, and this is what's so powerful about it, is that if you regard it instead as just experience, the physical world too is just experience. We see forms, we touch things, we feel the heat and cold. It's all experience. And when it's all experience, we realize that that distinction between the mind on the one hand and the material phenomena on the other is just a secondary thing. It is something that we derive from the primary experience, which just is experiencing the world. And then this whole problem, this thing they call dualism in philosophy, that problem of dualism falls away because experience is really all that is left. That's a very powerful way of looking at the world, just understanding it in terms of experience. Anyway, I'm just saying that because it's quite beautiful to understand that sometimes some of the things that people bring up as problems, if you look at the world just slightly differently, the problems just dissolve into thin air and there's nothing left. So how then about the idea of non-self? How do we see that during our ordinary experience? And what is your experience like? So you go through the day, right, and you see things. You wake up in the morning. You see your room, and of course, as you then move throughout the day, there's a continuous change in everything you experience. What you see is always changing, always moving. Sometimes disappearing completely. Something else arising. And then within that experience of seeing, then you hear something. But the sounds are just like the sights. They too, they arise, they come into existence, and they disappear again. It's continuous, like a kaleidoscope of things, always changing, always moving, never staying the same. You have your breakfast, you eat, and then the breakfast is finished. The taste is gone, and then there's no taste for a long time until you have your lunch again. You smell something, the smell disappears, it is gone again. And you see how your experiences, you touch something, again it disappears. How your experiences of the world are always changing, always moving, never staying the same. And then you can go to the mind state and you will see the same thing is true for the mind. You feel something, it feels happy, it feels pleasant, then it feels unpleasant, the happy feeling is completely gone. Right? You choose something, you don't choose something. Everything is always moving. So notice that, just in your daily life, notice how everything is always moving around and there's no identity, there's nothing there which goes across those experiences, which is always present, which is always unmoving, always staying there as a solid, core, which is left, which is a kind of the sense of who you are, which is a foundation for the sense of I. The sense of I doesn't really have any foundation. That's what you're starting to see here. So notice that. And that is already, when you see that, that is already the beginning of understanding what non-self is about, right? Just the fact that things are changing all the time. It's not very scary, right? It's fairly kind of ordinary, but this is actually what it means. Now, that is not enough, however. It's not enough to fully understand, of course, the Buddhist idea of non-self. To fully understand that, we have to go much more profoundly and deeply into who we are to be able to see these things. Because while you are still just watching your kind of kaleidoscope of things that's changing throughout the day, you are still on a very superficial level. You're not seeing very deeply into your mind. You're not seeing the most deepest feelings, the deepest states of consciousness, the deeper aspects of the mind. To be able to see that, you have to start developing your mind. You have to start to use the tools of Buddhism, which basically are the tools of samatha and vipassana, calm and insight. That is where you start to kind of get to real grips with the idea of non-self. And what happens, and this is, again, very practical, I will just think about the experience you had before while you were meditating. Some of you may have fallen asleep, or some of you may have been restless or thinking or whatever, but sometimes you feel more peaceful when you meditate, right? You feel really nice. And what is it that happens when you feel peaceful? What happens when you feel peaceful is that things start to fall away, right? The body starts to fall away. The body is not a problem anymore. The suffering of feeling tense and not relaxed falls away. Then the mind starts to become peaceful. You think less. So the thinking starts to fall away. And as these things fall away, you start to see that these things which fall away, of course, they disappear, right? They fall into the background. And eventually, there comes a point, perhaps sometimes, when all you are is aware of the breath in your meditation practice. Everything else is gone. Everything else has disappeared. You are still there, but everything else has gone. So what does that mean? It means that these things would have disappeared. They cannot be your identity, because they're not always there. They're not kind of continuing on, right? And the more deeply you go in your meditation practice, the more you understand that all these things that fade away and disappear, they are not your identity. They're not who you are. They cannot be who you are. And in this way, you gradually, you come to see what this idea of non-self means in a very practical and a very direct way. It's a beautiful thing when you see that. You actually see that all of these things. What you see at the same time, of course, is that as you become more peaceful, you become more happy as well, right? The less identity you have, the less there is of you, the more happy you are. Great. So chuck out some more stuff which you thought were you, and then perhaps you'll get even more happy. And you see that there is a correlation between the degree of non-self and the degree of happiness that you actually find in this world, right? Then non-self doesn't seem so scary anymore. Some people think it's very scary, this idea of non-self. But when you realize that it correlates with happiness, then of course it becomes much more beautiful and much more acceptable to people. And then as you go very deeply into meditation, eventually you come to the point when everything is so simple, everything is so basic, all you are left is this one stable perception inside of you, a perception of happiness, a perception of light, or something very, very basic. There comes a point when everything is so simple that you're able to see kind of the very, the most subtle aspects of the things that you have previously taken to be yourself. And only at that point, when things get extremely subtle, extremely simple, is it possible to fully penetrate and understand what the idea of non-self means. Because then you can see this to the core. You actually understand for the first time that there really isn't anything which goes across. It really is change. The change is absolute. There is no identity which moves from A to B. And the sense of I that you had before, really, it was just an illusion and it wasn't really worth holding on to. And what happens when you see that is that you get this incredible sense of freedom, of peace, of not having to bother so much with the world anymore. When you realize that there isn't this sense of identity inside, then you also understand that all of these things in the world, they're not about you. There is no real ownership. There is nothing which really is yours. There's nothing you can control. Things move, things change according to their own cause and conditions. And all you can really do is stand back and allow things to be. And because you allow things to be, because you don't control, because you're no longer in charge, you become incredibly peaceful and incredibly content with what is there. And this is that freedom of seeing non-self, just allowing the whole world to pass by on its own. And all you do, you are really the passive observer, 100% for the first time in your life. So that is what happens. This is the idea of this idea of non-self, seeing that there is no identity here. There is no ground, there's no foundation for this feeling of I that we have in there. The feeling of I is based on the sense of identity, something going across. It is a false thing. And when you see through delusion, seeing through delusion always must give rise to happiness as a consequence. So, I want to give you, this is kind of still perhaps very theoretical, but it's giving you some idea of how we move towards this idea of non-self, how we can use it in our daily life. But I want to look at a way we can actually use this idea. And how can we use this idea of non-self? What I've been looking at now is the impermanence of all phenomena and why that must mean that why there cannot be a self as a consequence. But how can we use this in a productive way? And one of the kind of defilements that we often, defilements, the problems of mind, if you like, that we often talk about in Buddhism, is this idea of conceit, right? Conceit, pride, arrogance, these are all kind of aspects of the same problem, the same defilements that we have. And it's very easy. I think we all probably feel a bit conceited sometimes. We think that, yeah, you know, this is who I am. I am, you know, more educated than these people, or I am of a higher social position, or I am nicer, I'm more spiritually developed than these people, right? That's a very powerful conceit. It's very easy to get into that one. Or I am more wealthy than somebody else, right? So that makes me that makes you conceited as well. There's so many areas in life where this idea of conceit can take hold. And of course, the most subtle of these is the spiritual kind of conceit, where you really think that you are better. And of course, the funny thing is that if you really think that you are better, that conceit kind of drags you down a little bit, right? Not quite as good as you thought you were after all, precisely because you have the conceit. So it's good to kind of abandon that conceit so you become even more virtuous. So how do we deal with conceit in life? And also, one of the points here as well is that in Buddhism, conceit doesn't just mean feeling superior. That's one possible conceit. But it's also possible to feel inferior. Inferior is also a kind of conceit because it's based on the idea of an I, on an identity. And in Buddhism, you also have the idea of equality, right? If you think you're equal, then according to Buddhism, you're still conceited if you think you're the same. That's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? But the idea is, again, because the very fact that you are comparing yourself, that comparison, that is the problem, that is the conceit, because comparison is based on the idea of me and I. So how do we overcome, say, a spiritual conceit? You think of yourself, I'm the great meditator, I'm the really compassionate and nice person, and all these scallywags around here, they are no good compared to me. So how can you overcome that? And to overcome that, a very simple technique is just to remember the idea of no self. This is where the idea of no self can come in very powerfully. Because let's say that you're conceited because you feel wealthy. I am rich, these people are poor, so I am better. But wealth is inherently unstable, right? We always hear about people who become poor overnight. Suddenly the wealth is gone. So imagine yourself, imagine that you were poor up to yesterday, and suddenly you became very wealthy. Suddenly you had $10 million in your bank account, right? And then tomorrow you are poor again. Now, if that is the case, then would you go around saying to people, I am wealthy, I am better than you, I am really, you know, I have all this money. Would you identify with that money if you only had it for one day? Would Would that be? Would you say to people that you are wealthy? At the very most, you would be able to say, "I'm wealthy for one day," but it would feel like a fake if you said, "I am a wealthy person." That wouldn't feel right, because you know you only have this for a very short period of time, for 24 hours, right? Now, this is true for everything in life. All things are like that. You have something for a short time. You have an education for a certain time. You have your intelligence for a certain time. You have your social position for a certain time. And then it disappears again. It might disappear in this life. It might disappear tomorrow. It might disappear in your next life. Who knows when it will disappear? But the whole point of this idea of non-self is that these things are not stable. They cannot last. And if they cannot last, how can you identify with them? How can you say that I am inherently superior when there is no inherent superiority, when superiority, or not superiority, but certain aspects of who you are must change at a certain stage? You know it is uncertain. It may not last. It will not last. You can be absolutely sure about that. And for that reason, you cannot compare yourself with another person. If tomorrow the other person is more wealthy than you are, how can you feel superior today? If tomorrow the other person is more kind than you are, how can you have the spiritual conceit today? Right? And this is a very powerful and a very beautiful way of overcoming conceit, understanding that there is no inherent quality. These things are not inherent qualities in you. They're just temporary things that pass through you and then they disappear again later on. And if you remember that, then you can never really get all that conceited, because you understand that there is no comparison between others. There's just changeability, things moving around all the time. So keep that in mind. This is to me, a very good way. People often ask me this question, how do I overcome this conceit? It's a very common question that you hear from people. Try that one to overcome this idea. Okay, so that is what I have been talking about so far, is one aspect of the sense of identity. And this is the aspect of permanence, the aspect of inherent qualities, the aspect of identity, that there is something there which you identify as, which is your identity, and that's why you have the sense of self. This is one aspect of the sense of self. And non-self, therefore, is the understanding that that inherent stability doesn't exist. There is another way of understanding non-self, or understanding the sense of self, and that is the sense of self. Not only does it require an inherent stability inside of you, it is the delusion of stability, but the sense of self also arises from the illusion of control. The idea that you are in charge, the idea that you can control things, that you can actually do things in the world and get things your way. This is the other aspect that the Buddha talks about again and again in the suttas as a function of the self, an aspect of the self. And if you reflect on that, if you think about what does it mean to feel that you have an I, when you have an I inside of you, what does that feel like? And what it feels like, I'm just talking from my personal experience, and I assume that it's the same for everyone here. But if you're honest about yourself, it feels like you have control over something, right? There is I. Because there is I, there is my stuff. I always means I have things. At the very least, you have your own body, right? As a monk, I don't have all that much, but I have these robes, perhaps, or I have my bowl, or I have my razor to shave my head, and these kind of things. So you have a few things. And that is your sphere of action. That is who you are. You have this ownership. This is your area of control. So this is the other aspect. One of the inherent aspects of the idea of a self is the idea of control around the world, with respect to these things that fall within your sphere of action. And this is how the Buddha, again, defines the idea of a self, this idea of control. But then you ask yourself, is that feeling of control that I have, this feeling that derives from the sense of I, is it real? Does it make sense? Do I really have this kind of control over the world, over the things within my sphere that it feels like I should have? And of course, once you start to look at the world kind of unbiased eyes, you realize that the amount of control you have is far, far less than you ever would have thought without reflecting carefully about these things. So for example, the sphere of action for an ordinary person, one of the most obvious spheres of action is our relationship with the people who are close to us, particularly a person we are married to or a life partner that we have. That is kind of the sphere of action, right? So how able are we to control that relationship? How much control do we exert over the relationships in our lives? And we often feel that we should control, right? A lot of relationships is about controlling each other. And you know that. We try in subtle ways to kind of influence the other partner. I'm sure you've all fallen into that trap of trying to control your life partner in a certain way. You want them to be this way. You want them to be that way. You want the relationship to work out, to exert influence on what is going on. This is just so natural. It is so basic to what life. And yet, despite that, we know how relationships often work out. They don't work out, right? Things go wrong, you end up with divorce, you end up with all kinds of problems. And in the end, the most certain thing of all, which you cannot control, of course, is death, right? Death is always going to block you from trying to control these kind of things. So relationship is a classic factor. But of course, somehow we feel that we are different. We will be able to somehow make this relationship work. But it's wrong. It's a delusion. The reason that you think you will be able to do it is precisely because of the sense of I inside of you. Your sense of identity is what distorts the reality to make you think that you can actually control this and make it work out. And for that reason, it doesn't matter how many times you see that that the reality of these things, it doesn't matter how you try to see these things, the delusion is still going to try to trick you to think that you are somehow different. And of course, it is not just with relationships, it is with all the things in life, all the things we own, everything. Anything you own in life is your sphere of activity, your sphere of control. And then one day your house burns down, one day your burglars come and take things away from you, one day something has happened. There's always things happening. At the very least, the day comes when you die, and it's all gone, and you certainly cannot control things beyond your death. So again, reflect on this. This is what is happening, the delusion of control, that we can control things within our own sphere. So if you look at this, what we are really trying to control here is not so much that we're trying to control the external things. Why are we trying to control all these external things in our life? The reason why we're trying to control them is not so much because of those things in their own right. What we're trying to control is our inner life, right? Our experience of the world. Now, coming back to this idea of experience again that I started off with, that is why we're really trying to control her. Because all these external things, they are actually about how we feel. We have a good relationship because it makes us feel good. That's the definition of a good relationship. We have all this ownership around us because it makes us feel good. We have a place of safety, our home. We have these belongings which makes us feel that we have we have things that give life a certain pleasure. So in the end, it's about how we feel, our experience of the world. That is what we are trying to control. And you can see this if you look at the Buddhist idea of dependent origination. You may have heard this Buddhist idea of dependent origination. This is one of the most profound teachings of the Buddha. And this is about a series of 12 links where the Buddha explains the arising of suffering in the world. And those a few of those links in the middle there, what the Buddha says, he says that when there is feeling, when there is an experience of the world, which is either pleasant or unpleasant, that feeling must always give rise to craving. Why is that? Because when you feel, either you like it or you don't like it. So craving arises as a result of that feeling. As a result of craving, we make lots of decisions in the world. We have strategies. We take things up. We decide how to live our lives. We decide to get an education. We decide to pursue sensual pleasures. We decide to have life partner, we decide to build a house, all these kind of things. We decide how to live. Why? Because those decisions on how to live, they are done because you want to fulfill the craving. The craving is something that cries out for action. Craving says we must act. We must do things to fulfill that craving. So what you're seeing here is that your feelings, how you feel the world, gives rise to how you live your life. It gives rise to our relationships. It gives rise to all these kind of things. And then it gives rise to trying to control those things. Because the feeling is dependent ultimately on those relationships, we try to control these things. So it all goes back to how the Buddha explained how the world actually functions. So this is the doing of things, the idea of self as the doer. So how does this, what is the problem with this? And of course the problem with this is that if you can't control, but you think you can control, you're going to end up suffering enormously because you try to control that which is uncontrollable. And as you start to see this, you start to let go of that control and you allow things to be in life the way they are. And to give you another example again, because I think the examples are often the most powerful, how to actually do this in your life. A good example is when something happens in life which is suffering for us. Say that you are, this is a sort of suffering that we all have in life, when you people say something to you that isn't nice, which is unpleasant. This happens almost every day, right? Somebody's going to say something which isn't nice. So how do you react to that when somebody says something which isn't nice? And of course, a very common way of reacting to that is to get upset, right? Why are they saying non-nice things to me? It's about me, it's about you again. And because you get upset about this, you have all kind of suffering as a consequence of that upset. But if instead of doing that, first of all, why is it that you get upset? And the reason you get upset is basically a function of control. It's a function of the idea that you think you can control the world. Anger and upset arises because you think that through anger, through that, you will somehow be able to rectify the situation, put them in the right place, and stop that suffering from happening in the future. But when you realize, and this is kind of the insight here, the understanding, the Buddhist way of understanding the world, when you realize that people saying bad things to you is always going to happen. You can't sort it out. It's impossible to stop that from happening. This is the way life actually is. And when you see that, you stop trying to change it, right? You realize it's an endless task. You can't change everybody in the world. You can't change everyone you come into contact with in your daily life. And when you understand that, when you understand that this is the way it has to be, then instead of getting angry, instead of trying to change the situation, remember, anger comes from this sense that you want to change things. Instead of changing it, you allow it to be. And when you allow it to be, something amazing happens. What happens is that you start to experience things again. When you get angry, you are projecting outwards onto somebody else. Your attention is going on to the object of the anger, which is the person, right? You're no longer experiencing the world. You're no longer experiencing what is happening. But by not getting angry, you can feel the pain. You can feel the suffering of the words of the other person. So instead of getting angry, you feel the suffering instead. So try that. Try to feel the suffering. What happens when you feel the suffering? What happens when you feel the suffering is that you start to understand life, right? The first noble truth is a noble truth about suffering. And this is just a very shallow way of understanding suffering. It's very, very simple. But you're starting to investigate the first noble truth of Buddhism, even though it is still very shallow. Instead of projecting or thinking about the other person getting angry, you feel life as it actually is. What a powerful thing that is. And this, of course, means that we start to get insight. We start to understand what the Buddha's teaching is all about, instead of just hiding behind a kind of a surface and something superficial like upset and anger. And what is powerful about that? What is so powerful about that is that when you start to understand suffering, it starts to change your perspective on life. Life isn't the same anymore. There's a Dhamma cockroach has come in to listen to the Dhamma. That's very nice. So, you know, I told you not to get reborn as a cockroach. That was a bad idea. This is what happens if you don't listen enough to the Dhamma talks, right? So instead of getting angry, you don't get reborn as a cockroach. You feel the suffering instead, right? You feel what it's like. And what that does to you, what is so powerful about that, is that it starts to change your priorities in life. Instead of the priority being of this world, you start to see the limitations of this world. And when you see the limitations of this world, your priorities change, and you start to orient yourself towards spirituality, towards the inner world, towards the mental world instead of always the outer world in this life, because you understand its limitations. So it's incredibly powerful. This very simple shift from getting angry to experiencing instead moves you to become a more spiritual person. Isn't that a powerful thing? And then you understand that actually developing the mind is really where it's all at, because that is something you can do something about. That is something that is within, really within your sphere of action, at least to some extent, whereas the external world is not. And then you do something where you can actually do something with your life, instead of spending your time, you know, on things that in the end you cannot do anything about. The reorientation of your life towards the spiritual matters happens as a consequence of just facing up to reality, feeling what reality is like. I'm not sure if I should say anything more. Maybe that's enough for tonight. I think it's probably enough. Otherwise, we can. Enough for tonight. Thank you very much. Okay. Any comments or questions by anyone? Anyone would like to ask anything or comment on anything or anything like that? They say that one of the causes for not being reborn as a cockroach is to ask questions. Apparently it's true. It's not a joke. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Anybody want to ask anything? Everybody happy? Everybody? Okay. Yes. Somebody. Is there a microphone around, or is it so we can hear what is being asked?
Ajahn, you were talking about continuity and carryover. So what about carryover in awareness?
Okay.
Or the experience of awareness.
Yeah. Well, this is very, very profound, right? Because it's the one thing that kind of seems to always be there, that seems to be ever-present. The world changes, your mental state changes. There's one thing that seems to be there all the time. That is the awareness of these things. And that seems to have a kind of continuity behind it. And I, you know, the point here is not for me to kind of tell you a kind of dogma. This is the Buddhist dogma, that according to Buddhism, this is the way it is. It's much more important to actually investigate these things for yourself and to see these things in reality. So I can, of course, tell you what the Buddha says, and maybe I will do that in a second. But much more important is actually to investigate and get a feeling for the idea of non-self in your own practice. And then it becomes powerful. It actually has some sense of meaning for you. Just hearing the word of the Buddha, sure, if you have enough confidence and faith in the word of the Buddha, it is powerful still. But obviously, it's even much more, much, much more powerful to see things for yourself. But what the Buddha essentially says is that there are six classes of awareness or consciousness. And these are the six classes related to each of the six senses. And he says that these are always changing. So awareness is changing according to which sense you're with. And the awareness with one sense is completely different from the awareness that you have with another sense. And when you see that, you see the discontinuity in awareness itself. And the feeling that awareness is a continuous thing is just an illusion. It's an illusion based on the fact that the mind consciousness, the mind is always behind everything. You see something, the mind is there. You hear something, the mind is there. And the mind keeps going. And because the mind kind of takes everything else as its object, the mind seems to be this continuous entity that is behind everything else. But if you investigate that, it's just six classes of consciousness, which are always changing, always moving around. This is what the Buddha says. So then you can see that even awareness actually is not an entity, is not an identity, is not something that you can take as the ground or the basis for the sense of I, just like anything else.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Miri.
Just following that up on the awareness. So if there are six types of different awareness, the ultimate goal is to see the impermanence of these different kinds of awareness, what is aware of the impermanence of these different types of awareness?
It is an inference that you make. Right, it's an inference you make. You see that something, you see that something is completely different before and afterwards. You see that there cannot be, there's no continuity between the two, because you see that one thing happens, and the next moment something completely different is there, and there's no relationship between the two things. So you can see that there has been an absolute change. It's like the car I was talking about before. It used to be a Beetle, Volkswagen Beetle. Now it's a Mercedes, right? There's a complete difference there between the two things. In exactly the same way, the awareness itself has changed completely from one thing to something else. And that is what you see here. And then from that, you know that there is nothing that has gone across. There's no inherent identity in that process. Okay. I know, Miri. I know. We have talked about these things before. So that's good. Thank you anyway for that question. Anybody else have any question here? Anyone else? Everybody else happy? Yeah, okay. So let's have a look at these couple of questions from overseas. Wow, this is interesting, isn't it? One from Germany and one from Syria. That's amazing. Somebody was sending a Dhamma question from Syria in the middle of all the going through down there. That's a wonderful thing here. Isn't it great that we can reach the Dhamma even to places like Syria? Isn't that great? I find that really, really positive. Anyway, let's see what they have to say. This is Christian from Germany. When I made many negative experiences in my life, I might develop out of these experiences an identity. What is low self-esteem and the meaning of the word self in this term? Okay, so it's exactly the same thing, right? Whether you have a low sense of self or you have a high sense of self, the idea is that somehow you identify with certain qualities. And because you identify with certain qualities, you make your sense of self out of that. That's really all it means. And it doesn't matter whether it's low self-esteem or conceit or inferiority feeling or whatever it is. It's just the sense that you have this identity. I am inferior. That's my identity. Not very nice identity. It's better to have identity, maybe I'm equal. I'm equal is quite a good identity if you're going to have anything. But neither conceit nor feeling inferior. But it is basically the same kind of problem. So ask yourself, this is how you feel now. Why do you feel like that? Tomorrow you feel different. There's nothing really there which is permanent or lasting. Investigate the reason for that feeling of inferiority. And once you understand the reason, and once you can see that that aspect because of which you feel inferior, if that aspect is changing, and it might be completely different tomorrow, then there's no basis for that inferiority. It's just an illusion, and you can perhaps discard it like that. But the other way of doing it is just to live a good spiritual life. And as you live a good life, as you do what is right and do what is kind in the world, generally you don't feel inferior anymore, nor do you feel conceited if you live it rightly, right? If you feel good about yourself, you just feel good about yourself, that's all. You don't really need to compare yourself with others at all anymore. You're just happy, content with your own life, and that's good enough. What other people think is irrelevant, and you can just go on with your own life. That is the best way of doing things. And this is what happens when you live a spiritual life, you do what is right, you feel that independence from the world. You become kind of sufficient inside of yourself. It's a wonderful and powerful thing. What other people think, comparison with others, all that just goes out the window after a while. Okay, then we have Aidan from Syria. So again, it's wonderful to be able to spread the Dhamma even to Syria. Non-self is like, I am nothing. If so, who can go forward in this life? So it's not like you're nothing. Non-self is just, remember, this is kind of the problem with this idea of non-self. If you grasp it in the wrong way, it leads to a misunderstanding. Remember that the problem is that the idea from a Buddhist point of view is that we are basing our life on an illusion, right? We are feeling, we are seeing, we are perceiving something which isn't actually there. We have the sense of identity, but it's not actually based on any facts. It's not based on any real phenomena which actually exist in a way that an identity can be formed around them. So there is a delusion. So you are no more nor less because of non-self. You're still just exactly the same person you are. It doesn't change anything. All it does is straightens out your sense of reality. It makes you more realistic about what the world is like. It doesn't make you any more nothing. It doesn't make you any more something. You are still exactly what you were before. And there is a very nice sutta called the Kacchanagotta Sutta, found in the Sangyutta Nikaya, is in the Nidana Sangyutta, which is the suttas on dependent arising. And this sutta, the Buddha says that both the idea does not exist is wrong, and the idea exist is wrong. Does not exist is wrong because it's not as if there isn't anything there. There is this continuity, right? There is this karmic continuity, which is you. If you look at yourself today and you compare yourself to who you were 20 years ago, there is a continuity, but not an identity. And this is, so there is not something, nor is there nothing. There's some kind of middle way. And this middle way in Buddhism is called the way of dependent arising, where phenomena arise dependent on causes. Our experience, our feeling of the world is just about that. Causes and effects moving around in this way. So it is still you who go forward. It is still, you are still there. It's not an identity you, but there is a you which is based on a karma and the results of karma. So you still take charge of your life. You still do what is right in the world. Even if there ultimately is no self, perhaps, you take charge. You do what you can right now. Don't worry too much about whether it's a self or not. If you feel that that is good because you have confidence in the Buddhist teachings, great. If you feel unsure about it, that's fine too. Don't worry about that. Do those things that you feel work for you. Be kind, be good. Do the things that enhances your own life and also enhances the life of the people around you. And then you will grow regardless. And then eventually, one day, when as a result of all the good things you do, your meditation becomes more profound and you start to see these things for yourself, then you can have a final opinion about these things. So don't worry too much about it. If you find it hard to understand, put it to one side for now and then get back to it later on, time and again, and see how things work out for you. Okay, Eddie, yes. You want to say without the mic? Yes. Some kind of secret, is it? Yeah. You cling to the self, but there is no self.
Yes, yes.
Wow. That's a problem. Yeah.
Yes. They call it emptiness of human existence.
Mm.
The Mahayana is empty. Mm. The five skandhas are empty of human existence. And they have the soup, like, you know, the Dhinadana, Chichanda, Namo,
Okay, yeah.
It's very important.
Yeah, it is. Of course, it's very important. I agree with you. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Maybe that's enough, Eddie. Yeah. Otherwise, it becomes a Dhamma talk, a second Dhamma talk. One Dhamma talk is enough. Otherwise, we get really, it's too much otherwise. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for that. I agree. It's very important. Anybody else want to say anything here? Everybody very happy with everything? Wonderful. Yes, at the back there.
Hello. I just want to know what the Buddhist belief in regards to altruism is.
Altruism?
Yeah, altruism.
Okay. Basically, the Buddhist idea is that kindness and generosity is a very powerful thing here, and it's a very, very useful thing here. And it is useful for other people, of course, when you're kind to them, of course, very useful, but it's also useful for yourself. And there's something about when you give something to others, investigate that. I mean, find these things out for yourself. It's not, this is not just dogma. This is the idea here, is this is something very real. But in my experience, when I do something kind for others, I feel good. I feel happy about things, So it's not a kind of giving where you're altruistic and you feel miserable afterwards. It's giving and actually feeling good about yourself. This is the whole purpose in the Buddhist teachings. And this is actually the foundation for the whole spiritual path. For meditation to really become profound and deep, you have to have that sense of goodness and happiness inside of you. And that goodness and happiness comes from, in a large part, from being altruistic, from being kind, from being compassionate, from being generous. You get enormous results back. This doesn't mean that when you give something, you think, yeah, I'm going to get some happiness now. That's not what you think, because then it actually destroys part of it. You just do it, knowing it's the right thing. And then the things come back all on their own. It's a kind of a non-self way of being selfish, right? Anyway, I'm sure you get the rough idea. Does it make sense to you? Are you happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Anything else anyone wants to say here? Everybody happy? Okay, let's over here as well. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that on the topic of the no self and like comparing yourself to others, one of the things which helps me is true self-esteem and true humility come out of the realization that we're all pretty essentially the exact same thing because we don't have a self. And the fact that we're pretty much all just gonna die and turn into dust, and that so essentially every single one of us in here is the same. Yeah, yep. And especially it's really important in today's society when you're constantly comparing yourself to through social media and
I don't know anything about that, but anyway, that's probably true. Yeah.
Oh, it's very strong. Yeah.
Okay. No, I think that's a very good point, is the idea that, we are much more the same, much more equal as human beings than sometimes we like to think. We like to think that I'm special, I have these special qualities, I'm different or whatever. But in the end, we are so much of us is the same, right? We have very much the same aspirations. We all want to be happy. We want to have fulfilling lives. We all want to move very much in the same direction. We don't want to have suffering. And inside of us, even if you look at people from very different societies, very different backgrounds, very different cultures, still those root things are basically there for all people. And so we are very much the same. There's no, there's no grounds for having nationalistic feelings, for example. I'm very proud of being from such a nation or whatever. I mean, it's just nonsense. You go to any other nation and you find that people are essentially the same. It was a wonderful teaching given by one of the great Ajahns in Thailand, the great teachers in Thailand. He said that, what's the point in traveling around the world? You travel around the world, it's all the same wherever you go. people are the same. There's nothing different. Okay, the food they eat is a little bit different. The customs are a bit different. You know, the clothes they wear might seem funny to you because it's slightly different. But essentially, it is all the same. There isn't that great difference there. So I agree with that. It's almost like a bit kind of depressing to say we're all the same. You feel depressed straight away. But then you realize, actually, it's quite a freeing thing when we're all the same and we don't have to have this conceit or arrogance or whatever. Anyway, so enough for tonight. So let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.